All right, y'all, it's spring, and you know what that means. It's time to start planning our summer festival traveling. Yep, it's time to get into my Airbnb bag cross-country, a.k.a. Time to visit my homes all across the country. And you know what I never think about? Why not list my own spot on Airbnb and host some folks at my house? I mean, my house is cute. Yes, let's make money while we're spending money. Just trying to help you out, man, because your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
I'm Johnny B. Goode, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CentraTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire.
If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio. This classic episode was produced by the team at Pandora.
What's up? This is Unpaid Bill for Questlove Supreme. On this week's classic, we revisit May 30th, 2018, interview with journalist and author Ronan Farrow. He dropped by to talk about his first book, War on Peace, and the chat led to talking about family, Mos Def, and Ronan's pursuit of the truth, episode 86. Enjoy.
Supremo, Supremo, roll call. Supremo, Supremo, roll call. Suprema, Suprema, roll call. Suprema, Suprema, roll call.
I am for real.
Yeah.
I am so down.
Yeah.
Ronan Farrow.
Yeah.
Expose these clowns.
Roll call. Suprema, Suprema, roll call. Suprema, Suprema, roll call.
My name is Fonte.
Yeah.
I can't play the word litzer.
Yeah.
I never had a bar mitzvah.
Yeah.
Congrats on that poo litzer.
Oh, 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 yeah. Suprema, Suprema, roll call. Suprema, Suprema, roll call.
My name is Sugar.
Yeah.
When I heard Pharaoh.
Yeah.
I was like, oy vey.
Yeah.
Not again.
Suprema, roll call. Suprema, Suprema, roll call.
I'm on paid bill.
Yeah.
And life is hard.
Yeah.
When you live inside.
Yeah.
House of Cards.
Roll call. Suprema, Suprema, roll call. Suprema, Suprema, roll call.
So Isla Iyam.
Yeah.
And Ronan Farrow.
Hey. Yeah.
Everything he says.
Yeah.
Yeah, I follow. Yep, me too.
Roll call.
Yep, yep, yep.
Suprema.
Just, you know, roll with it.
Suprema.
Don't matter.
Roll call.
Just me too.
Suprema.
Suprema, roll call.
I'm Ronan Farrow.
Yeah.
I'm here to stay.
Yeah.
I cannot freestyle.
Yeah.
But I got other redeemers. Quality. Yeah, yeah.
Suprema. Suprema, roll call.
Why is there no Suprema?
Suprema, roll call.
Wait a minute. You started to croon and shit.
That was amazing.
For crooning.
Guys,
crooning
Pharaoh. We definitely need another take, but there's promising stuff there.
Yeah.
We are a one.
Bar mitzvah Pulitzer.
I love
well played, my friend.
Bar mitzvah.
How long did it take you to figure out words that rhyme with Pulitzer?
I was outside and I saw the. I knew bar mitzvah and then I saw the word litzer outside. I was like, aha.
You could be like Pulitzer Soul Sister.
Yeah, that works as well.
All the revelation comes after roll call. Before roll call, there is nothing we can think of that, you know, that rhymes with the word that we intended.
You do that every time? That's exhausting.
That's like
a hazing ritual.
And you're
100%.
What episode is this? Like,
this is like 80
something. We're in the 80 something.
Congrats on your 80 something episode, guys.
Thank you.
That means each freaking roll call has been somewhat customized.
I have all mine saved.
You're a lie. I swear to God. Throw my
phone. Oh, yours. Okay. Like, but it's going to be
also
important.
Mostly off topic because
I like to be as off topic as possible.
Wait, this is weird because this, well, this is the one, yours is always political, yeah. No matter what. Like, even if we have like
100%.
Like, you know, the food episode,
right.
You'll talk about what happened right. In the news that week. So that's you're true. Like our political conscience.
A little bit, yeah. But not really.
Is he our
but
Professor
I was,
Griff?
I was going to try to do a non-political one this week because it's political to fuck with you all, but I didn't.
Yeah, I was like, me. You better stick to stuff. Yeah, you better stick
nah,
to something.
Nah, Ronnie here. We
but
about
Zara's
to
here.
Go
by
in.
The way, special guest Zara Zolman to today. Who's
just say the word
expert.
Hi.
Okay. She's very shy. Yes, my goal is to get her to open up.
Yeah, we
it's like therapy.
We
but
are literally yeah. We in place of Boss Bill, Zara, one of my seven managers, is here.
Ooh, maybe we can get into it later. Ooh,
no, because
yeah.
It's not about me
okay.
Right now. Yeah. Our special guest.
You're right.
You know, I will say probably one of the hardest things to do. I think in terms of David and Goliath is taking a stand and calling people out.
Yeah. Whistleblower. Yeah.
Sticking to the truth, especially when terms like fake news gets thrown around a lot. And, mm-hmm. You know, there are a certain few that still don't know who to believe, you know, the 85%, I guess. Anyway, this man has... In my opinion, he's leading the charge, and he's a mighty David to the world's Goliath. His new book just got released, War and Peace.
Thank you.
I want to talk about that.
Yeah,
welcome,
Ronan
Farrow.
Plug the hell out of that, guys.
Yes. Welcome, Ronan Farrow.
Thank you.
Time,
thank you. It means a lot to hear that from you,
influential.
yeah. That how cool
I
is
saw,
that?
I saw your speech last night. That was really incredible how you bigged up your mom for it, you know.
Yeah. Look, I brought with me actually one of the first women who went on the record in these stories I wrote about Harvey Weinstein. And, you know, there's a reason for that. I was there because of her. And I feel like we have all benefited so much from the example of how brave these women were. And you're right, my mom was there too, and she is a super brave woman who has gotten a lot of flack for standing up for her daughter and for women's rights, and I owe a lot to her.
Yeah. I gotta say, even like news of you writing the New Yorker piece and your work before, of course, we at one point worked in the same building at 30 Rock, what I call 30 Rock University.
Mm-hmm.
I'll just say that you graduated.
you kicked out, graduated, you know.
Well,
we'll talk about that later.
Yeah, you know. But
you definitely had a cooler lair in 30 Rock than I did.
Yeah, but you guys were the know-it-alls, man. And like I, you know, I was always a big fan of the third floor, all the cats at MSNBC.
Yeah, yeah, there's some great reporters there.
But I'll say that even though I believe maybe the first time I met you, I recall, did you guys ever attend a show with Mos? I know at the time when he was doing Be Kind, Rewind.
Yeah. Wow. That is a piece of obscure IMDb trivia. my mom co-starred with Mos in
right.
this Michel Gondry
she
movie.
She sure did.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember
and
that.
She loved Mos. She was like, this guy is the salt of the earth. She thought he was so sweet. He was so supportive of her.
I thought at
on
one
set.
Point that you guys, that was going to be like the adoption thing. Like, Mos was just going to be
like he was
going
to be the latest addition to the Farrow family.
Exactly.
I could have sworn
that I saw even I don't know if it's you or your siblings at one of his shows that I happen to be at.
Totally possible. I
okay.
mean, I'm a big fan of his.
Okay. So, but I'll say that my true introduction to you was your Twitter feed, which was super fearless. At first, I didn't even know you were journalists. I just thought, yo, your zingers are.
I'm glad you like them. They have gotten me in trouble.
Yeah,
over
I was going to say how did the your Father's Day tweet? I don't know if this is the white elephant in the room, whatever. But your Father's Day tweet was rather interesting.
I had some spicy tweets in my day.
Yeah, but you know how did you deal with that? Because usually I get a lot of clapback from, you know,
yeah.
my inner circle.
Yeah, I mean, you know,
but you just always, has that always been you? Like, I'm going to call it out. If I see bullshit, I'm going to call it out.
For sure, for sure. I think when you're calling out bullshit, through careful investigative reporting, you do have to then be careful about like being glib on social media. Right. So it's a delicate balance. You know, it depends on the topic.
So you can't be. Yeah, you're not.
I think, you know, while I'm in the middle of such sensitive stuff and I'm so under fire from some pretty nasty people that I've exposed.
You can't be jokey.
You know, I still get a little in edgewise.
Especially
but
in the last, you know, few, I want to say weeks.
Yeah,
you know,
during
Pulitzer
this period.
Time, these things. It's like, okay, Ronan's, your Twitter might go more PG now.
It's right? A little more PG. Yeah. Yeah. I also think, you know, Twitter has changed. Like, our cultural moment has changed. There was a period where like I'd go on with, you know, Jimmy and he'd like read his favorite tweets of mine, and right. I don't think we do that anymore. Like, the novelty of Twitter wore off, and it's now more for me anyway, like a Rolodex of fellow reporters rather than like a joke medium.
Oh yeah, it's more like, it's like the morning papers now. It's like the morning paper.
Yeah, yeah, right. It's more of just a news aggregator for me.
Hashtag is a thread, you know.
Yeah, it's a thread.
It's
right.
A thread.
Yeah.
So nothing's funny anymore.
Yeah, nothing's funny. Well, you guys are still funny. That works.
So just as a young person, when did you realize that this is bullshit and I have to stand up for something? Or were you the tattletale of your siblings? Like, what?
I was not a snitch, Amir.
Because it's weird. Just from where I came from, like, I was raised, okay. One time, I used to be the cousin that told, ooh, the cookie jar.
Real, I believe.
Right, but I was raised like, my uncle would punish the guilty party and then punish the snitcher.
Yeah. Everybody, yeah.
Hell,
yeah.
It's like,
yeah.
What did I do? He's like, you're supposed to stick together. You're
supposed
not
to
supposed
together.
To
yeah.
Which is like, that's kind of weird. At a young age, I'll say that at least culturally, black people were slow to call things out. And then maybe by their teens, then it's like the tell it like it is thing. Because then you just realize that this is bullshit and I got to stand up. So, I mean, at what point did you feel like, or my own two, I got to...
I was always raised with a really strong spirit of public service and justice. And I think a lot of that flows from my mom being like, a recovering Catholic schoolgirl who, you know, still really was inculcated with that kind of save the world attitude. And I think, you know, speaking the truth and cutting through bullshit, even when it means putting a lot on the line, is a big part of that. But what's interesting when you talk about snitching is, you know, my day job as an investigative reporter requires both a lot of telling of hard truths and also a lot of keeping of secrets. Right? Because you're dealing with all of these anonymous sources. Yeah. And, you know, even when people go on the record, you know, you have to be very careful about parsing out the parts they want to say, the parts they don't want to say. And one of the most important things I do is respecting people's privacy.
Right. Well, let me make clear. Snitching is, at least culturally for us, snitching is like when you're part of an operation and then you
that's
get
snitching.
Caught.
Yeah.
And then you rat everyone else out. No, you're cool, because Boss Bill's not here.
Oh,
everyone leave your ringers on, right. And I want you guys to chew
to
on the microphone.
We're all going to be taking calls during this podcast.
Just take some calls and, you know, chew on the microphone. Yes, sound effects, all this stuff. But so I would not necessarily say, I mean, keeping a secret is necessary in your line of business, and I feel that's not.
You walking back?
I
like the
introduction
point you made.
Interesting point. That's why
super interesting.
I wanted you to go back to what you said about him and your brothers and sisters, because when you came in here, you were already talking about your brothers and sisters. And how many do you have? And
I am one of 14.
Okay,
wow.
It's a lot.
And your last name is not Johnson.
Right. And where are you in the scheme of the 14?
There are four younger than me. 10 of my siblings are adopted, and most of them have, you know, really traumatic, difficult backgrounds of various kinds, you know, adopted from terrible situations of poverty and abuse. You know, many of them adopted older at a point where basically they would not have found a home otherwise. And, you know, those are the people I love most and I grew up with. And it really gave me this incredible sense of perspective. It's hard to like sob into your soup about anything when you have so many of the world's challenges right at your doorstep.
So from the gate, being one of 14, like you're automatically taught community service and that sort of, I mean, it wasn't a silver spoon situation, then you decided. Because there's some people that like they grow up privileged and rich, and then they realize, like, yo, this is bullshit, and I got it.
And, you know, I'd never, like, complain of hardship in that respect, because Lord knows I've reported on and seen plenty of real hardship, and I didn't have that. But, you know, I was raised by a single mom who was, at that point, you know, not working all the time, and it was very clear that we all had to strike out and make a living as early as possible, and... Right. You know, not everyone could go to private school. It was merit-based, and, you know, we were really fortunate. I was supported through my whole childhood, but it wasn't opulent, and, you know, the flip side was that there were all these very real traumas and often really just physical challenges that I saw my siblings go through. So I was exposed to that from an early age.
Wait, you said something interesting. You said going to private school was merit-based?
Well, you know, a lot of my siblings had the benefit of, like, wonderful public schools in our towns that we grew up in Connecticut. We moved around a little bit. It was New York, Connecticut.
You weren't born in New York.
I was born in New York, and then I spent my teens in Connecticut. And it was kind of, I think it was an individual decision for each person. Like, okay, what are they going to benefit from most? You know, how good is the local school? You know, what makes sense? Are they really going to get a lot out of some kind of a specialized program? You know, whether they either, you know, need more attentive education because they've got special needs or because they're excelling in a particular way and that needs to be tended to.
That's a lot of work for your mom. Like, that
is unbelievable work. She was an incredible mom, and I saw her shoulder this huge burden all by herself. Do any of you guys have kids?
Yeah, I got the... two boys, 17 and 12.
So you know what a handful.
They're my kids.
It's a lot. It's a lot. And I can't imagine doing that all alone, you know, while making a living with so many kids. It's a lot to bite off. I definitely grew up knowing that I didn't want to adopt 10 kids, but I also grew up really admiring the hell out of it.
It's a good life lesson. Is it? Yeah. How is it fighting for your own space and your own voice and your... I would assume that you had to be diplomatic and, you know, the biggest vote wins and we get to watch this channel and, you know.
Yeah, a lot of early negotiating skills. I hadn't thought of it in that way, but that's probably true. I mean, a lot of fighting over food. You know, we were a dark meat family when it came to chicken, and the dark meat was always gone. You know, there's never enough drumsticks to go around.
Yo, son, your last name is Johnson.
No, listen, we just had a whole conversation about good hair and whatnot. And it's funny because that was my next question to you, like breaking down the diversity of your brothers and sisters.
Yeah.
Because that provided such a different understanding for you, you know, especially as a white man.
Totally different understanding. I mean, look, I'm still a white guy and I would not claim to understand what it's like to grow up as a black woman in our society. But I can claim to understand what it's like to grow up, you know, with a bedroom next to the bedroom of a black young woman. And that's a lot. That's a whole... I mean, I want to be careful because I was telling you before, like, I have, you know...
You have black siblings.
Yeah,
I did not know this.
Yeah.
Okay.
I have black siblings. I have Asian siblings. We were real, like, United Colors of Benetton. And
Josephine Baker clan.
Yeah. I know, you know, I have, you know, there are black women in my life who are very disapproving of the Chris Rock documentary that you just mentioned, the good hair.
That's what we're talking about. I wasn't going to put you on, but it's an interesting conversation.
Really? It is an interesting conversation that people have about that. And it's not really for me to say, you know, how sensitive he was or not, because I'm not in that demographic. But certainly I got a taste of the hair traumas of, honestly, the childhood of just about any girl of any color, because... as I was telling you earlier, my Asian siblings were like getting perms and wanting curly hair. And, you know, my black sister was like, you know, going through the whole rigmarole of like straighteners, relaxers, and, you know, going out in the rain and it's all ruined. So God bless anyone who finds equilibrium on their hair, whatever color it may be.
Wait, time out. So you had a problem with good hair?
No, I didn't.
Not
have
her.
Not me.
Oh, okay.
I saw, she was supportive. But I saw the point of it. I saw the point in the problem because I was saying, you know, at the end of the day, Chris Rock is a man. And so it was from a perspective of a man and a lot of things were left out. That's what we were talking about.
Oh, okay. Now I gotta watch again and see.
I mean, white people I know loved that documentary. I'm like,
of course, because I knew nothing.
So full of insight now. Yeah,
right.
And I was kind of surprised then, you know, you talk to black women about it and it's a little more split down the middle where, like, you found things to respect in it. And I mean, I certainly enjoyed it and I
just
think it was
well intentioned. Just that it was done and his intentions in doing it when it comes
to
his daughters.
I think that's right.
Yeah.
Did not know that. Okay. Where did you go to high school? Did you all go to the same high school? Well, you're all not the same age.
I mean, there's a huge age span. I actually did not go to high school.
Huh. But you went to college at like 16, didn't
11.
You?
11.
Oh.
Wait. Deal, deal with it.
Wait, time out. All right.
You graduated at like, you graduated college at 15, right?
Yeah.
Oh,
whoa,
bad.
Time out.
And you're I'm late. You do this about me, Amir.
I did not know this about you. And wait, time out. Explain your schooling.
I
and how can I be down? Oh, like there's a DeLorean.
It's
that's
too late.
Going.
I think I'm
it's
about over. To say.
We missed that. We missed the Ronan Farrow plan.
Look, I don't know if it's a good idea, but it's what happened. I was super nerdy and was bored in school, and I was lucky enough to get like a, you know, a brochure for this Johns Hopkins program where you can take college courses as a kid.
You said Johns Hopkins like it's nothing.
Yeah, they have this thing. It's so embarrassing. It's called the Center for Talented Youth. I'm so sorry, guys.
No,
drop it.
Own it.
Just own it. Yeah. So anyway, I and these fellow nerds would get together and like take college courses in the summers. And
how old were you then?
This would have been like, you know, from age 9 or 10 on. So the way you get into that summer camp is you take the SAT. And so I took the SAT and I got a score where people were like, oh, okay, you should just go to college. So I did.
Wow. And this is at 9 years old?
So the SAT, you know, I took it a couple of times in that period.
Ordering. I don't understand.
So you had to retake it to get it. This is more detail than you did. But anyway, I got a baller SAT score.
And was
I
it kind like of went to college.
I got a perfect 60. SAT score.
Oh, shit.
No one is ever going to want to be my friend.
No,
I've worked
dude. I'm actually going to
be your friend.
No. Okay, this is what I'm
you
telling
you. You will be my only friends after
yes,
this.
Yes, we will.
No, but peep it. All right, so I don't know if I told the story of my birth doctor or not, but like, he was trying to get my parents to think. You know, I was born in the early 70s, and there was like a new way of thinking and all that stuff. And he was trying to get my parents to kind of go out of their boundary comfort zone when it came to raising me. Now, they geared to more towards entertainment and whatnot. So he told them, like, you know, when he wants to write on the walls, let him write on the walls.
Oh,
and let him.
That shit.
Out of my house.
Right. Mm-hmm. Anything in a black, anything in a plastic covered house.
Yeah, let him jump on the good sofa and
right. I violated all this stuff. But that's how I became a drummer.
Okay.
After a while, it was like, okay, he's destroying too much furniture. What do we do?
Get him something to beat
on. Get him a drum set. And then that's like around 2. But he definitely said, like, make sure before the age of 5, you let him just, you know, he's going to be curious about a lot of things. Like, of course, if it's a fork to the socket, stop
yeah,
that.
Yeah, don't do that.
But let him draw on the walls. Let him play in his food.
Would you raise any kids you have that way?
Hell no.
You don't want to lose those couches.
See, I feel because of I've seen the result, and I have cousins that were or under a strict, like this restrictive lifestyle. And I've seen the results of being too restrictive, what that does once they're teenagers and you rebel against. Like, TV was taken away from me in my formative years. But as a result, as an adult, like, I'm totally addicted to TV. You know what I mean? So it's sort of...
I actually had the same evolution on video games where we were a no video game household, and then I became like a real nerdy gamer as a result.
What do you game? What's your joints?
Oh man, I've got
are you Xbox or PS4?
PS4. I'm a PS4 guy. Yeah.
It's post college, I'm sure.
Yeah, but kind of, you know, I was so
you make up for lost time.
I was so subversive that, you know, I was the kind of kid where when I was told you can't get a Nintendo, I was like, here are all my arguments on why this is an important art form. And writers of my generation are going to be going into video games and telling important horizon expanding stories. Mom.
Hey.
So you bullshitted.
But also there was some truth
to that.
And then I would like, you know, rig up emulators on my computer to get the Super Nintendo games and the N64 games. No, like, you know, just terribly like hacked together versions I'd download, but so I could play them. I'm not advocating piracy and emulation here. I get it. I'm just saying it was a phase.
I was like, I figured you just built your own video game. Like,
so what do you game now? What's your game on PS4?
So yeah, I have a PS4. I grew up on, partly as a consequence of that ban on consoles, computer games, okay, which were allowed, yeah, which are a little more cerebral. Like, yeah, do you remember like Myst from, yep, the 90s? Myst is my jam. And there's actually now that, similar to some of the transitions in the music industry, there's much more of an indie scene in gaming right now, yeah, because publishers have declined.
Have you played that Inside for PS4?
Inside is a beautiful work,
yeah,
of art.
That's a crazy,
it's like Scandinavian game, I think, right? Yeah, yeah. Maybe Danish.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like black and white, yep, and that's very evocative. And yeah. Yeah, man, we got to go deeper on this. We're losing the rest of the crowd.
No, this is like watching a tennis game.
And we're learning actually, about Fonte. I'm like, what?
This is a side of him that I've exposed.
No, we're very much a rabbit hole show. So.
Yeah, so I love the kind of the lineage of those Myst-type adventure games and other kind of artistic games that are a little mysterious and make you think. And
Flower,
a lot of those
played Flower?
Love Flower, love, yeah, Journey. That
I haven't played Journey.
Journey's
yet.
Great.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what
there's a game for
games?
PS4 called Soma, which you should 100% play, like best writing, best story, okay, I've seen in a
Soma,
game.
Soma, S-O-M-A?
Yep.
So these are like a choose-your-adventure games?
Nah, like this Zelda is like, or? Inside is just a game where you're a kid. Uh-huh. And it just drops you in this world, and you just, it's a side scroller game. So, like you
Mario
can die. So,
kind of?
Yeah, it's like Mario.
Okay.
And you can just die in so many different ways, and it's these puzzles you have to figure out. And,
but it's sort of this very evocative, beautiful backdrop of like a kind of an Orwellian, like 1984
so, yeah,
repressive like, society. So, it's much more about like the experience than the puzzles.
Than
the
actual
jumping
puzzles.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then Flower is like if PM Dawn designed a game.
Say what?
Flower is like you, where you are a petal of a flower. It's amazing high. Dude, you're a petal of a flower and you play as the wind. So you have to direct the petal to go through this garden to pick up more flowers, and they, the music. I don't think Ryu should suck them over. Yo, I didn't, but a couple of my homies
Catch
did.
It.
Yeah. Dude, it's a beautiful game, and like on Wii, it's even better.
I love that you're this gentle soul. You love these like these gentle stoner games.
I mean, but I play Doom too, though, so I like Doom.
Oh, yeah. The new Doom is great.
Doom is amazing.
Really well done.
And Last of Us.
Yeah, loved The Last of Us.
That's like a screenplay.
For sure. I hear the new God of War is excellent.
I got it. I have it downloaded. I haven't started it yet because I got work to do, and I know once I start it,
it's
over.
You and me both.
Yeah.
Mom met a lot of your demands over the years. This Mother's Day, get her the Bartesian cocktail maker that makes premium cocktails on demand. In just 30 seconds, have your choice of over 60 premium or seasonal cocktails, all at the touch of a button. Get $50 off on the Bartesian cocktail maker now when you buy one pack of cocktail capsules. So, for all the times you made a mess, get Mom the countertop cocktail system that makes premium cocktails without making any mess at all. For all the times you begged for soda, get her premium cocktail capsules made with real fruit juice and craft bitters. For all the times you demanded tacos for dinner, get her the Bartesian that mixes margaritas in just 30 seconds. Make Mom's Mother's Day and all the 364 days that aren't Mother's Day with a Bartesian cocktail maker at $50 off. Visit bartesian.com/mother now to get $50 off the Bartesian Premium Cocktail Maker. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
My name is Johnny B. Good, and I'm the host of the new podcast, Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon. Over this 9-part series, I'll explore the life and crimes of my best friend, Ray Trapani.
I always wanted to be a criminal.
If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
You see, Ray has this unique ability to find loopholes and exploit them.
They collected $30 million. There were headlines about it.
His company, CentraTech, was one of the hottest crypto startups in 2017. It was going to change the world, until it didn't.
Came into my office, opened my email, and the subject heading was FBI request.
It was only a matter of time before the truth came out.
You can only fake it till you make it for so long before they find out that your Harvard degree is not so crimson.
How could you sit there and do something that you know will objectively cause more harm in the world?
Listen to Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you ask two people the same exact set of seven questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same seven questions, including actress and star of the mega hit sitcom Friends, Courteney Cox.
You can't go around it, so you just go through it. This is a roadblock. It's going to catch you down the road. Go through it. Deal with it.
Comedian, writer, and star of the series Catastrophe, Rob Delaney.
I shouldn't feel guilty about my son's death. He died of a brain tumor. It's part of what happens when your kid dies. Intellectually, you'll understand that it's not your fault, but you'll still feel guilty.
Alt-rock icon, Liz Phair.
That personal disaster wrote Guyville. So everything comes out of a dead end.
And many, many more. Join me on season 3 of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Seven questions, limitless answers.
First of all, hats off for AfroPix, off to you for your New Yorker piece.
Thank you.
What, I mean, the what gave you the nerve or the gall or the audacity to even say, all right, I'm gonna go after it? Because I would have figured that every editor or every boss of yours would have tried to shut you down.
Yeah.
Maybe the House guilt of the Democratic.
Style. Yeah.
Or the guilt of the Democratic Party, you know, being as he was one of the biggest supporters or whatever, like that could have just like.
A lot of powerful forces trying to shut it down.
Yeah. And how did you manage to bob and weave your way out of that to something that actually not only stuck, but worked?
I'm just so relieved and so grateful because of all those obstacles. You know, the most important answer is that these women who came forward did this incredibly brave and difficult thing. I mean, I worked with them for months and we had so many tough conversations about the pros and the cons and the threats to their career and the threats to their physical safety. And, you know, as you know, one of the articles I wrote exposed this whole system of hiring like combat ready former Mossad agents. Yeah. I mean, like there's real cloak and dagger stuff going on here. And from the beginning, you know, the women involved in the story were warning me of that. And I knew that every single person who had told their story did it because they thought it could help protect the next woman to come along. And because they had done this incredibly difficult thing, I just wouldn't have been able to live with myself if I had allowed it to be shut down or if I had given up. The other aspect of it is by the time I got to the decision point of like, okay, my life is falling apart. I got no more career, like nothing. Like this is, maybe I, you know, swung too wide on this. I couldn't go back because I really had, like, I gambled everything, you know? I'd spent a year of my life and all the opportunities I thought I had and was pursuing had gone away. And the only choice I had was to stick with it.
Did you feel like your exit at MSNBC was like, was that the end of the world? Like when you walked out of that building with your box or, I don't know. I can always tell when someone leaves MSNBC because of a certain white box that they carry outside of. And it's never a happy look on their face when they're carrying.
I mean, leaving anywhere where you thought you were building a future is incredibly hard. I was at the time not at MSNBC. I was on the Today Show. But, you know,
I'm sorry,
still
just
in the building.
Consider that one big
yeah,
ass.
No, it's all one news organization. You're right to consider it the same. And, you know, I'm really proud of the work the investigative unit did on a bunch of stories I worked on there. And yeah, you know, look, things changed as I was working on this story.
So at the time of the Today Show, did you hear any rumblings of Lauer? What was happening with Lauer at the time?
I am going to have to be careful what I say in this conversation about that.
How about that?
you're a tough interviewer. You don't know, but you are.
I thought I was asking soft questions, like shit in the past.
Look, okay. I think there's a lot of valid questions out there about how all these things connect together. And, you know, I got to make sure that that story is told in the right way at the right time.
That's what I was going to ask you because you chose, well, obviously this book must have been in the works before.
It was, yeah.
Okay, because there must be something in process to tell the story of your process in doing this article.
Yeah, I think further down the line, people are right to hammer me with questions about this, and I will make sure.
So you have not officially talked about.
No.
You're like, okay. Oh, I'm sorry. I just assumed that once the deed was done and, you it's know, yes. that it was like common knowledge.
No, look, I mean, I will say broadly, the story behind stories like this can be important because when something this important and this dangerous stays quiet for this long, that's not an accident. And there's a lot of reasons for that. And I think, you know, now that we are grappling with the underlying allegations, and it was really important to me that the women's stories be at the center of the conversation. So I also didn't want to distract from that. But I think as we get further and further out, you know, it will be important to really take a hard look at ourselves in the media and across our society and look at the systems that keep these sorts of things quiet.
How long did you research that the Weinstein story? Was you said it was a year?
First interview was done in January of last year. The first, you know, research and calls would have happened sort of October, November of 2016.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So about a year.
So, your book.
My book. My long-suffering book.
We're in Homer Pace. When did you first start writing?
By the way, I love that image of you with War on Peace in your lap. I snapped a picture. I'm Instagramming that.
It's right here. How long was the process to?
Way too long.
Yeah, and you had to fly around the world a little bit too, right?
Yeah, like, yeah, you saw. There's all sorts of crazy exotic locations in there. It took 5 years, all told, to write this book. And a lot of the actual writing happened at the end. And part of that was because the Weinstein story like took over my life. And right at the moment where I was supposed to be in crunch mode for the book, I was juggling these two giant things.
Were your editors understanding, like, okay?
No, they were not. They actually they dropped the book, and I had to resell it to a wonderful team at Norton, my current publisher.
You serious?
They are mad. When did they yeah, drop?
People are mad. A lot of people are in regret mood now.
Yeah, because right? I need to know, when did they drop?
Right at as the Weinstein story was heating up. This would have been like April of last year. Yeah. You know, there's great people over there, and I'm sure they're doing fine. But it was obviously a huge blow to me personally. And there are so many brave whistleblowers that, you know, they knew and I knew had gone on the record for this book. And I couldn't let them down either, because this book is the story of, first of all, transformation in America's role in the world. That's really important to all of our safety. And second of all, of brave men and women in an unsung career who are really getting pushed out right now and denigrated and who are profoundly misunderstood and abused by politicians.
They're abused by the public, because it's funny, because I was thinking to myself in reading, because I didn't read the whole thing, but I ran through it and I was like, oh, so now I feel bad about beeping at the guys who get to park anywhere they want to with the diplomat tags. I was like, I'm born and raised in D.C., so I'm like, why does he get to park anywhere he wants to and do what he wants to? But now I get it. I'm like, okay.
These are men and women who turn down opportunities to make a lot more money in the private sector, who go to the most dangerous and difficult places on earth at times, move their families around every few years, and they do it because they know that their work makes the United States safer. Yeah, I mean, they are the first line of defense against dangerous people getting into our country. They are the people responsible when you get into a crisis or get taken hostage and you got to get pulled out. And they're the people who, hopefully, if we empower them, which we are not, broker the deals that keep our brave servicemen and women out of conflicts. You know, war should not be the first solution.
Well, you said that people would think that with this current administration that we're, quote, under, that sort of the decline of diplomacy overseas and in other territories. Most of us would think that the decline is starting now, but you actually said that it was... This has been going on, like, during the Clinton and during the Bush 1 and the Reagan administration. So
there's two things going on here. A lot of the book is devoted to the crisis under the Trump administration I mean, this is a crazy new extreme where we are literally purging the State Department, just mass firings, hundreds of diplomatic posts empty.
Empty, right? Can you say the number? It's like a ridiculous number.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it changes all the time, so I don't want to give a number now because it'll change by the time we... And sometimes it gets worse, not better, by the way.
They get rid of more, okay.
Yeah, but it's... We're talking about, you know, major embassies without an ambassador, major offices around the State Department without an assistant secretary to run that region. And it means that we're flying blind in all sorts of big challenges all around the world. I bookend War on Peace with the story of this guy, Tom Countryman, which is his real name, unbelievably.
That's, wow. That's not his nom de plume.
Yeah, that's not like a stage name. That's okay. His real name. And he is indeed like a patriotic guy, you know, served in all these dangerous places for years and years. And he was the top official on arms control at the State Department. And he got fired within days of Trump coming in. And you think about that, like at a time when we're facing down Iran and North Korea and arms control is one of our biggest challenges, we just gave the boot to our top expert on that field. So a big part of this is the Trump era. But you're right, you know, when people say this is unprecedented, that's not quite the right word because there's a lot of precedent you can look at and draw really clear lessons from. You mentioned the Clinton administration. Clinton, over the course of the 90s, cut spending on development and diplomacy by 30%. And we closed all sorts of embassies around the world. The embassies we had left were short-funded. We shuttered two really important government agencies, one on information, which obviously we could use that skill set as we go up against ISIS propaganda, one on arms control. And, you know, these are lasting pieces of damage that we really felt after 9/11 when we needed diplomats more. And instead, obviously, what we've seen is everything gets run through the Pentagon.
Yeah. Your book, it's interesting because, number one, I wanted to big you up because the way you kind of explain things as you go and you learn about the State Department and you learn about everybody's role, but it also becomes very scary as you really realize, to dumb it down, that we don't have as many friends in these countries as we used to. Mm-hmm. And when it comes to American representation, which is kind of scary. And then it goes back to the White House, who are the only ones really communicating with these outside entities, which is...
So are you saying in the case of North Korea, there should have been way more... did we ever have representation in North Korea at all?
So it's not about wanting an embassy there. You know, I think everyone agrees that like it wouldn't be the right thing to recognize them as a state in that way at present until they reform in a whole lot of ways. But what we have had in recent history are really concerted efforts led by really experienced diplomats to have talks with them and other players in the region that can kind of squeeze them and exert pressure, like the Chinese. So under George W. Bush, for instance, there were 6-party talks led by this guy, Chris Hill, who's a career diplomat who's profiled in this book. And, you know, it's too simple to say that he just failed. You know, they worked really hard around the clock for a long time. They got North Korea to shut down some of its reactors for the first time. They got some concessions and some transparency. In the end, you know, it fell through. North Korea didn't follow through to the extent we wanted. But there were significant inroads made in our ability to talk to China about this. And we've just thrown that all out since then. And,
yeah, because Trump said he's the reason that China is talking to us.
Yeah, and you know, Trump is trumpeting a lot about the... I'm so sorry for that accidental pun. I'm so glad you saw it. about this, you know, meeting potentially leader to leader in the North Korea crisis. I just got to say, and this is addressed in the book, what all the experts who have been immersed in trying to crack the North Korea problem for years say is, time will tell what that means, a meeting like that, because North Korea is really wily. They lie all the time. And there's a real risk that we get played. If you go into a meeting leader to leader, it can be a way to legitimize them as a nuclear power. They can run around saying, hey, now we're recognized and we can have nukes. That's one of their key demands. We don't necessarily have a long-term strategy in which to embed that meeting. And that's a problem because we no longer have a core of experts devoted to North Korea at the State Department.
Well, yeah, that was a downer for everyone.
That's how I felt starting. That's how I felt reading that book. I was like, so this is not going to have a happy ending because
it's hopeful too. There's some hope in this book. I mean, I talk about the fact that there are still these brave men and women doing this work in difficult places around the world. And I talk about some of the examples in recent history that suggest that if we support them, you can actually turn things around.
So where do you think it's important and they are there? Because they've been pulled out of so many places.
I have one quick question, though. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. I believe that, you know, obviously in the name of pettiness, I believe the Trump administration is just shutting down or firing at will, who he pleases.
Mm-hmm.
What were the reasons, or at least between the Reagan and the Obama administration? Did you see the decline of diplomacy around the world? Like, what were the reasons of, were they saying that, okay, in this particular place in Zambia or this African nation, we don't need, you know, five diplomats there?
So I'm careful not to oversimplify the problem. The State Department bureaucracy is slow moving. It's broken and outdated in a lot of ways. And, you know, part of this conversation is people saying, well, we need to cut back because we need to reform. And I think that that's not unreasonable. You know, intelligent reform, where we reshape what our diplomacy looks like, is a great idea.
But there's no plan. Is there a plan
there's
somewhere?
No, there's no plan. Okay. They are cutting muscle, not fat.
What's the idea plan?
Well, you know, the example I would point to is, since you were asking about history, you know, during World War II, I went back and found a lot of the old headlines covering the State Department then, and they sound a whole lot like headlines about the Rex Tillerson State Department in the past year. Oh, wow. People saying, we've got a broken State Department, you know, it's not doing its job, you know, we need to throw it out the window, we need to reform it. And what's interesting is what we did then, which is, instead of throwing it out, we really reshaped it for a modern era. You know, mass communication was on the rise. We created all sorts of new offices and new priorities. We cut older offices that were now outdated. And you ended up with a period where we had the creation of, you know, NATO and the UN and the World Bank and all of these structures we still rely on. So I think you can reform it if
not
you want to.
Not in this administration, though.
Well, like, this administration doesn't seem to want to.
This is what I'm saying. It's going to be empty positions. Just emptiness.
Yeah.
I'm curious to get your take on what you think the role of technology plays in kind of our decline of diplomacy, just because this is the first time I think we're just living in an era where information and misinformation just flies so fast, you know what I mean? And so I'm curious, what do you think, like, you know, when you were talking about, you know, like 40 years ago, like during the, like Bush won, I mean, there was no Twitter, there was no social media. So now stories can break and, you know, it may be all the way sourced, it may be whatever, but it can just go so off the rails. What do you think the role that social media has played, either good or bad, like in the role of all that?
It's a really good question, and it's something I talk about a lot in the book. The rise of, you know, instant communication technology has profoundly affected the role of diplomats, right? You don't need an ambassador in a foreign land to deliver a message anymore. Like that cool kind of magical responsibility that they once had of, here is a letter from the United States, isn't how it works anymore. And I think that that's part of what allows some of this destructive political rhetoric, where there's just the constant denigration of diplomats as, you know, dusty bureaucrats who don't get anything done, which I think is really unfair and shortchanges the important work they do. The fact that we don't need letters delivered in person anymore doesn't mean that we don't need experts who understand the most complicated crises on earth and know how to get American citizens out and protect their interests and cut deals that advance our influence.
Yeah. That's real.
So if we are lacking, or if we're declining, and I don't know how sharp that decline is, I think I know the answer, but who is picking up the slack, and who is slow to win? Who's on point right now as far as...
I'm glad you asked that, because one of the kind of the like shadow that is cast over this whole story in the book is that China is doing the opposite thing right now. And, you know, I don't mean to hold up China as some paragon of virtue. I think it's pretty troubling if China is filling this space. But the fact is
it?
Yes. I mean, I think there are pros and cons to Chinese leadership, and it varies around the world. But certainly, I do think the United States, despite all of our flaws, is still a more sincere and ardent defender of human rights. Mm-hmm. And I do think that we want American influence, you know, in large part, despite all the ways in which we screw up and can be a malign influence. I think it is a good thing for the world if we are running things correctly. And what we're seeing right now is in important places around the world, China is investing in more and more diplomats. And I'll give you an example. You know, I was in Sudan for a while, and in Sudan, China for a long time played the role that we kind of stereotypically think of China as playing, which where they're this interloper that is totally callous about human rights, and they're extracting the oil and like aiding and abetting a genocide. And I wrote about that a lot at the time. Now China has like a regional envoy who's doing shuttle diplomacy, trying to like cut a peace deal there. So they have a whole, yeah, because they want to ascend to a status of global leadership. And there are kids all around the world growing up with really clear signs of Chinese leadership and development, big infrastructure projects in places where we no longer even have embassies.
Wow.
Yeah.
Shit.
Yeah, that's kind of my reaction too.
Better start learning Mandarin.
Kind of, yeah. We got to do our roll call in Mandarin next time.
Mom met a lot of your demands over the years. This Mother's Day, get her the Bartesian cocktail maker that makes premium cocktails on demand. In just 30 seconds, have your choice of over 60 premium or seasonal cocktails, all at the touch of a button. Get $50 off on the Bartesian cocktail maker now when you buy one pack of cocktail capsules. So, for all the times you made a mess, get Mom the countertop cocktail system that makes premium cocktails without making any mess at all. For all the times you begged for soda, get her premium cocktail capsules made with real fruit juice and craft bitters. For all the times you demanded tacos for dinner, get her the Bartesian that mixes margaritas in just 30 seconds. Make Mom's Mother's Day and all the 364 days that aren't Mother's Day with a Bartesian cocktail maker at $50 off. Visit bartesian.com/mother now to get $50 off the Bartesian Premium Cocktail Maker. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
My name is Johnny B. Good, and I'm the host of the new podcast, Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon. Over this 9-part series, I'll explore the life and crimes of my best friend, Ray Trapani.
I always wanted to be a criminal.
If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
You see, Ray has this unique ability to find loopholes and exploit them.
They collected $30 million. There were headlines about it.
His company, Centratech, was one of the hottest crypto startups in 2017. It was going to change the world, until it didn't.
Came into my office, opened my email, and the subject heading was FBI request.
It was only a matter of time before the truth came out.
You can only fake it till you make it for so long before they find out that your Harvard degree is not so crimson.
How could you sit there and do something that you know will objectively cause more harm in the world?
Listen to Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you ask two people the same exact set of 7 questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same 7 questions, including actress and star of the mega hit sitcom Friends, Courteney Cox.
You can't go around it, so you just go through it. This is a roadblock. It's going to catch you down the road. Go through it. Deal with it.
Comedian, writer, and star of the series Catastrophe, Rob Delaney.
I shouldn't feel guilty about my son's death. He died of a brain tumor. It's part of what happens when your kid dies. Intellectually, you'll understand that it's not your fault, but you'll still feel guilty.
Alt-rock icon, Liz Phair.
That personal disaster wrote Guyville. So everything comes out of a dead end.
And many, many more. Join me on season 3 of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. 7 questions, limitless answers.
Let me ask you, you know, I'll say that at least okay, I you know, I still watch Maddow's show, and it's sort of kind of like my lullaby. Like, I gotta see what, you know, just so I can sleep at night.
She's great. She's so principled.
Am I? Is 2018 a pipe dream? Is it?
In terms of impeachment?
In terms of midterms, the idea of, like, do you?
Oh man, I'm not going to handicap that race. All I can say is I'm going to keep on telling stories that I hope are relevant to voters as they make informed decisions. And, you know, I've been exposing some of these secret election season payments in my latest round of New Yorker stories. And I think there's a lot to uncover here about the abuse of power and how powerful people can distort people's perceptions during an election. And it's not my job to project whether that has any impact or to hope that it has an impact.
Are you speaking of the Facebook situation or the...
That's part of the whole soup of things that happened, but the last few stories I did were about secret payments to...
National Enquirer
stories. This practice of catch and kill, where there were, you know, stories that might have seen the light of day and didn't because of transactions that were covered up at the time, seemingly on behalf of the president.
But it's obvious that people... you know, he wants to make that statement, like, I could stand on Fifth Avenue,
shoot somebody,
and nothing would happen to me. And I'm almost thinking, like, oh, he's absolutely right. Like, his believers are going to believe what they believe.
That's what I was thinking.
But in a case, but then there's a case of, like, Shania Twain's statement last week.
Yeah, when she was looking
where at. She said that, you know, as a Canadian, and I know, like, there's the people that scare me the most.
She said she'd vote for Trump if she could.
Yeah. Yeah, because she felt he told the truth. But
Shania?
Here's the thing, that don't impress me.
Still the one that stole it.
But the thing is that I believe that if she truly saw what was happening and was informed, she would know better. But the problem is
you guys have to get Shania on here and have that conversation.
No, don't walk her out like that, Amir. You're giving her a lifeline.
Oh, I'm not capable for Shania whatsoever. Okay. But this is the person that I know. Like, I keep my television on 24/7 watching news. Mm-hmm. Now, is it subsequently also bringing down my spirit as a human being? Am I being less productive? Because I gotta figure out, even when I bust into Zara's office, who's not speaking at all right now, she can match you note for note.
I know. Do we get one sound bite by the end?
She literally, like...
I wanted you to ask about Mike Pompeo.
Okay.
Hey, but why don't you ask about Mike Pompeo?
What do you want to know?
Sarah, what about Mike Pompeo?
Yeah, I was just wondering if you think things are going to get better if he gets in there.
So I would say two things. One is, here's what we know about Mike Pompeo's record in terms of his position on the issues. You know, he's extremely hawkish. He has been right there with the president, saber-rattling about dismantling the Iran deal and stepping away from a diplomatic approach. You know, the president sent him, right after firing Rex Tillerson, to meet with the North Koreans, you know, while he was CIA director. So he's already been sort of part of this moment where we're seeing the work of diplomats outsourced to soldiers and spies. That said, I've continued to talk to all these whistleblowers whose stories are in War on Peace, and hope really springs eternal with them. You know,
mentioned in there that this is not a first time thing, because they made the mistake. I think the Clinton administration made the mistake with Colin Powell, and they said that they made a mistake with replacing diplomacy with.
I think
military.
Multiple administrations realized they made a mistake on this. You know, late in the game, the Clinton administration, after his first Secretary of State Warren Christopher, sounded a whole lot like Rex Tillerson defending these deep cuts to the department. Madeleine Albright came in and was much more focused on large-scale diplomacy. During the Bush administration, you know, after the disasters of Iraq, Condoleezza Rice is on the record in this book talking about, you know, needing more diplomacy. And that's the period in which they took this run at the North Korea problem. And I talk about that as well. Often this realization comes too late. There are senior Obama administration officials saying, you know, we kind of expressing regret about the fact that they had an Afghanistan policy that was really overtaken by celebrity generals, and how they tried to course correct and get more diplomatic views in the room later on. And you wound up with the Iran deal, the thaw in relations with Cuba, the Paris Climate Change Accord. So if you invest in diplomacy, you can get results. You just have to have leadership. And, you know, to circle it back to Mike Pompeo, I think there's a lot of hope right now about him. there's a lot of sincere hope that he will invest in diplomacy and defend that institution and believe in the brave men and women working there, which we haven't seen so far in this administration.
What's going to be the final Jenga cube that you pull that everything's going to crumble down?
Oh, man.
Because it seems like...
Do you feel the pressure? Because I don't want to put that on you, but I feel like
I'm sure you
did it before.
Guess.
You can do it again. Yeah. Like, one of you is going to get that all the President's Men movie. Like, that should be your motivation.
Yeah, I thought it was going to be Stormy Daniels.
It's not not my job to, you know, try to bring down anyone. It wasn't even my job to try to bring down Harvey Weinstein. My job was to make those survivors feel heard, which they hadn't been for a long time. And I think similarly with the reporting I've done on the Trump administration and even the stories I tell in this book, you know, my job is to get as close to the truth as possible and to pull back the curtain on stuff that people haven't wanted you to see.
How can you... Okay, so doubling back to... Because I realized I didn't clear myself up with Shania, so you can cross your arms.
You guys have beef right now about Shania.
I do.
But listen, my point was that I feel as though there are people who... Their whole thing is I just can't. I can't watch the news. It kills me inside. And I understand, you know, it's so overwhelming to deal with your life and then to see what's happening in life there. But it's like I'm one of those people that has to keep an eye, even though I'm not totally immersed in it, and you know,
but you care.
Yeah, and I don't feel as though people don't care, but I do feel that there are a set of people that because it won't affect them easily as it will others, you know, like I have friends and family that are already affected by the DACA situation. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, that shit affects me. But how do you reach people that are indifferent to watching the news that, you know, if I can get through a day where I don't have to explain to someone and filter it and explain in their language that they understand what's going on. Mm-hmm. Or sometimes I go in Zara's room like, all right, what? That hour where I'm shooting Fallon, 6 o'clock, usually my first thing is, all right, what happened? You know, and based on her face, some days she's crying because some shit happened or, you know, it's...
All the news.
How do journalists get their groove back where, you know, where you're counterattacking propaganda television like Fox. Can I call them that?
I think that's...
Is there one person at Fox
fair
you respect?
Yeah, there are individual people at Fox I respect, but I do think that...
Who are they? who's the two people that know the truth?
You know, look, I think Shep Smith does fairly straight coverage.
I actually like Shep.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, he's okay. And I think there are people like... you know, I don't want to endorse everything each of these people does wholesale, but like Brett Baer does some sort of more, I think, you know, on the straight and narrow news kind of stuff. But okay. But yes, I think overall, you know, that is an organization with some very clear ties to the people they're covering. And they do a lot of damage to the conversation. I do think that.
But how come the world just can't, not the world, or Americans can't see that?
Well, so to your first point, I think you've highlighted one of the most important and difficult challenges we have as a society, and as reporters, too. Apathy is, in a lot of ways, the enemy of progress, and it's one of the toughest nuts to crack. I totally get and empathize with the fact that people despair when they watch the news and they just want to turn away.
It's overwhelming too.
People get overwhelmed. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I do think that the mainstream media deserves some blame for the way the 24-hour news cycle.
Yeah. It never goes off.
Yeah.
You have to turn it off. Like, you have to set your own filter of
It's alienated
and
people.
And it's the same story sometimes. Not the same stories, but yes. The same stories.
So I think we're part of the problem is systemic, where there is a broken news system where the business model is built around rereading the same headline over and over again and not offering anything new to the conversation. Mm-hmm. Or doing the other thing that's cheap and easy, which is put people in a room and have them shout at each other.
Yeah, just talking heads. Yeah.
All of which I think has conspired to make people tune out. And that's really dangerous because we need people who, like all of you sitting here, really profoundly care and are going to be engaged and cry if the news cycle dictates that and want to stand up and do something. We all need that. And so, you know, I hope in the small part that I do to tell stories, I'm doing it in a way where people know it's not part of just hammering them over the head with the same old headlines. It's not part of the partisan echo chamber. You know, it's really giving them some facts that maybe they can be armed with as they make decisions.
Has anyone approached you yet about doing movies about any of your stuff, like either One Piece or your Weinstein stuff? Because I think that's going to be, when you talk about
just, how you reach people?
Yeah, getting over the apathy. Because I'm one of
Oliver
those people.
Oliver Stone style.
Yo, I'm straight up like, yo, all the Trump stuff, I'm just like, yo, just I'm just waiting for Jerry Bruckheimer to make the movie. And I will know
everything. Oliver have it.
Well, who's your casting choice? Yeah. Who do you cast?
Who you cast for Trump? Alec Baldwin. Let's just keep the party going on. Yeah, man. Like, I'm just waiting because it's just so much information and you don't know what's what, what's a lie, what's true. So I would probably fall into one of the categories. I'm not just totally apathetic. You know, I stay up to some degree, but certainly it's a point where you kind of have to shut down. I was like, look, I got kids to raise. I got to do my thing. So I can't be inundated with it all the time. But I was curious if anyone has, because all this stuff, I mean, just the past couple of years of your life is prime ready for.
There's some crazy stories there. Look, I have a lot of respect for storytelling in different mediums and the power to expand people's horizons with those stories.
About to give us a real political correct statement. Go ahead, Roman.
If you can't give it up, I mean, don't fuck up the bag.
I think that.
I understand.
I think you're right. I think that, you know, these stories can reach different audiences if you tell them right, whether it's in, you know, a careful piece of investigative reporting, or a movie, or a book, or a song. I mean, there's a lot of ways to move people and help them understand important issues we all grapple with.
Yeah, because I thought about you before I did.
Right? No, for real.
No, because before we in kind of my prepping for this, I watched the Paternal. Have you watched the joint on HBO? The Paternal.
Oh,
movie?
I haven't. Is it good?
Yeah, it is good. It is good. But it's more so about like the investigation and how.
I should be watching that as an HBO guy. I've got an HBO deal starting soon, so I'll you'll be
breaking
seeing
news,
it.
Breaking news,
exclusive.
HBO. I'm sorry, I'm
so crazy right now.
But no, I think you'll.
No,
dig
he deserves it.
I got a sample.
Yes, you got one.
Yeah, so I'll be turning some of these stories into documentaries, and you know, I'll be back on TV. And I think part of that is because you're right. There's different ways to get to people, and they're all important.
Is there something bubbling under that you're working on?
Yes.
Yo, you said
you
that.
You knew that was going to be nice. Wait. You're like, nope, done. Like,
I even heard the exclamation point at the end of the S. Okay, so when you have a scoop that you know that you have, who's your trusted circle? Who is your... Because I don't know the dog-eat-dog world of journalism or whatnot, but when you know you have some shit that no one else has.
So I write for The New Yorker, and I am really happy to say that after all of the challenges of the past year, you know, I landed in a place where there's just some of the best damn journalists on earth supporting me. Yeah. And David Remnick, who runs The New Yorker, who you guys should totally have on. I want to hear him in a roll call. Yeah. He's a damn hero. That guy is cool as hell. And rescued the Weinstein story and stood by it when it was under attack. And, you know, as I work on upcoming stories, I got a great circle of editors that are circle of trust there and fact checkers as we get closer to the finish line on each story. And it's a wonderful institution. Wow. People should subscribe.
I mean, can you keep it real? How real are the...
You know I always keep it real.
But how real are the threats? Like, is it barbershop talk or is it some... real
shit.
Yeah,
no, it's some real shit, unfortunately.
But I mean, like, because
you even moved
like,
out,
you,
right? You
moved.
You,
I did move out of my place.
Like
at the
you're end. Not, I mean, you know. This
so
is
when you're in
recorded,
a parking
so.
Lot alone, is it like over the shoulder? Is it?
Yeah, I mean, it comes and goes. I think there are periods where I'm working on a specific story where it gets very, very adversarial, where that is very much the vibe of like, okay, am I being followed? What precautions do I need to take?
Because that National Enquirer, that was a big deal. Like, I mean, if Stormy's looking over her shoulder, yeah, you're definitely looking over yours when you're saying his love child.
But I almost
and there,
like,
and there was a story in the New York Times last night about some of the connections between those allegations of intimidation and, you know, people that were getting hired. And this is all stuff that will continue to come to light. But yeah, the answer is it's real.
Well, I'm just saying that in the 60s, they handled it a certain way. Whereas I feel as though because there's cameras everywhere, it's hard to execute that sort of, you know.
I hope you're right. I got to call a friend. I mean, I hope you're right that it's harder for people to, attack other people because of the surveillance.
Yeah, well.
Plus, this ain't House of Cards for real. Like, Ronan, can't anybody just, I just can't see.
No, yeah, I think it is House of Cards for real.
It is.
I will say, without talking about the specifics of stuff I've reported on, in general terms, I have been startled at how close it is to fiction and how, you know, kind of cloak and dagger tactics that I didn't think existed in the real world really are part of the tool set deployed by powerful people when they're on a rampage trying to stop something from coming out.
But almost the thing that I marvel at the most is that I don't think that this current administration is truly aware of the power of how technology works. Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like they're so old school, 70s, 80s old school, just keep it between us, not knowing that we're going to find out the information anyway. Like,
I mean, it's this weird dichotomy, right? Because Trump is also like the king of Twitter and like late night tweets and early morning tweets and tweets with typos.
It's just so obvious that he comes from the school of, if you say something enough,
they'll believe it.
Like, I can tell, you know, a whitewash when it's so obvious and transparent.
Yeah.
That, I guess this leads me to my last question, which is, do you have hope for 2018? And if you do, what do you project we'll have?
I guess to the extent that I engage with electoral politics at all, it's just wanting to tell stories that arm people with as much useful and accurate information as possible. You know, I truly, that's not a cop-out. I don't think in those terms. I really just think in terms of what's the most important story I can go after. I think that telling the truth is good for society as a whole, and I hope that that is also helpful for the electorate.
It's funny.
So you're not going on record with,
it's not the world I'm in, you know? I'm not in that
just
world
tell
of
the
politics.
Truth as a
I gotta play, man.
But wait,
fair enough, I earned that.
But what's funny is you mentioned Madeleine Albright, and I was also thinking about, what do you think about Madeleine Albright and people like James Comey, like writing these books? I mean, in the season of War and Peace, your book coming out as well.
Yeah, Madeleine,
like,
Albright is in my book too. She was wonderfully candid, and has a great history of public service, and is obviously very frank, both in War on Peace and her own book, Fascism, A Warning, it's subtitled. I don't say this in a disparaging way, but a partisan, so she can talk more freely about.
So then James Comey.
With James Comey, it's much more, obviously he's like dodging and weaving bullets, and it's a whole careful process anytime you have a government agency reviewing your book. And I think it was almost inevitable that it was going to be a minefield for him to do a press tour for that book.
So the wrong time.
I don't know. It's not for me to say. I also haven't read the book, so I wouldn't want to say it's the wrong time for it to come out. Maybe it's the right time. I don't know. But, I think he's deftly trying to navigate those potholes, maybe. You are super disapproving.
No.
She's got this look on her face like, mm-mm.
No, I'm happy that he came out. But again, it kind of goes back to what Amir said. At the end of the day, like, no matter who comes out, there's a certain population, a certain people that...
They're going to pick their own facts.
They don't see it.
For sure.
There's something wrong with him.
They'll believe whoever is wearing a tie says it's true.
Because, I was all hyped about the book, but then I realized I'm hyped with the same people again.
Well, this is one of the problems that we have to deal with in terms of the media landscape, where the president was clearly able to exploit, you know, both through these catch and kill operations via the Inquirer and also the general co-opting of a tabloid media outlet that runs constant headlines that are, you know, pro-Trump and anti-Hillary Clinton.
It's amazing.
Well, because it interfaces with that audience that you're talking about that's not necessarily part of the conversations you're in, but they are seeing those magazine covers on the checkout line. Yes. So there's an interesting, you know, I'm not a media reporter, but there's an interesting media narrative here, which is this split nation of we're all in our own partisan bubbles. Oh, yeah. We go on Facebook and Twitter and it's algorithmically curated. So you only see views you agree with.
Yeah. It's an echo chamber.
Right. And then for the people who don't watch the news, you know, there's this whole other parallel reality of National Enquirer covers and the checkout line at the supermarket. And none of these groups are talking to each other. And that's a real problem. That's, you know, bigger than anything I am able to solve right now.
That's weird to me that National Enquirer is still a thing.
Like, oh my God, yes.
Man. I mean, it's not in terms of the media conversation, but it is in terms of
the grocery
store.
Yeah,
like kind of grocery not to be, store. Yeah, like, lowest common denominator. Like,
I'm not saying I haven't been. I've been to a grocery store a few times, but
oh shit.
Motherfucker, they don't have it at Whole Foods. I'm just saying.
No, she's trying to give me
that. There you go.
She's trying to give me that.
That 1%.
Stop now. Stop now. You didn't even say Trader Joe's. I can't.
The people at Whole Foods are the people in your conversation. They're not the people who need convincing.
Right. That's what I'm saying.
Some of the people are. I don't watch the news. Like, I work with a lot of. I don't know. I think it's almost dangerous on the Whole Foods side of things because, again, I know and I work with a lot of people who, you know, they can afford to turn the other way and not look, you know.
And that disappoints me. Yeah. That
hurts me more.
Yeah, nothing like a rich liberal. Ain't nothing like it.
Yeah.
So, I hope everyone with the power to raise their voice is doing so in an informed way. That's all. This is the apathy that we've been hitting on again and again is a really dangerous and disappointing thing. People got to care.
Yeah. And you made us, not to go back to the book, but War and Peace made us care about diplomacy because, again, I wasn't even thinking about
it. Thank you. I hope so. I think the brave men and women doing this work deserve that.
That's great.
Thanks, guys.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you for coming.
See you guys soon.
Yo, can we do the whole title is War on Peace, the End of Diplomacy, and the Decline of the American Influence. Pow wow.
Ah, those are heavy words, ladies and gentlemen.
I know, all right. Scary.
Ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of Sugar Steve, Zara Zalman, I'm Faith Bill, and Fon Tigolo.
Don't say Boss Bill too, because he thinks
it's like yeah.
He always say we forget about
and
him.
Boss Bill. Of course, we deal with this.
His collection of green tea Kit Kats is nasty as hell.
The worst. Sorry, Kit Kat, that was a bad idea.
Anyway, this is Questlove. You were listening to Questlove Supreme, and be safe, everybody. Thank you. See you on the next one. Bye.
Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio. This classic episode was produced by the team at Pandora. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
I'm Johnny B. Goode, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, the story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CentraTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, the story of BitCon, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
My whole life, I've been told this one story about my family, about how my great-great-grandmother was killed by the mafia back in Sicily. I was never sure if it was true, so I decided to find out. And even though my Uncle Jimmy told me I'd only be making the vendetta worse, I'm going to Sicily anyway. Come to Italy with me to solve this 100-year-old murder mystery. Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey there, I'm Dr. Maya Shunker, and I'm a scientist who studies human behavior. Many of us have experienced a moment in our lives that changes everything, that instantly divides our life into a before and an after. On my podcast, A Slight Change of Plans, I talk to people about navigating these moments. Their stories are full of candor and hard-won wisdom. And you'll hear from scientists who teach us how we can be more resilient in the face of change. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.